This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, we're seeing yet another devastating storm of epic proportions. We haven't even begun to adequately assess the damage of Hurricane Harvey on Texas. And now, a week later, we're watching a powerful Category 5 hurricane plow through the Caribbean and the track of the storm that heads straight for Florida and points north.
While we are concerned about the effects of such storms on the U.S., we also keep in mind these smaller countries who are far more vulnerable in many respects and will be dealing with the aftermath for years to come.
The kind of coordination required with these two back-to-back storms is impossible to calculate, and the health impacts could be enormous.
Well, relief agencies are already stretched to capacity. This new assault on Florida and the East Coast will tax the system and the people who staff them even further as regions brace for the worst. And that brings us to our guest today. Dr. Rebecca Gee is the Secretary of the Louisiana Department of Health.
Dr. Gee is a real leader, and I'm looking forward to that conversation. And she'll be talking about lessons learned from Hurricane Katrina, as well as subsequent weather events, and how that has helped them plan a storm preparedness protocol that other states might learn from. Really looking forward to this timely conversation, Margaret.
And Lori Robertson will be stopping by, the managing editor of factcheck.org.
But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com. And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you.
We'll get to our interview with Dr. Rebecca Gee in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. The Senate Health Committee undergoing 2 days of hearings on next steps for health reform. Several of the nation's insurance commissioners and several governors testifying before the bipartisan committee on ways to stabilize the insurance marketplaces. There's been a nascent effort at seeking some bipartisan solutions to the health reform conundrum. Many of those testifying asking for Congress to automatically bolster the cost-sharing subsidies, which allow insurers to keep premium prices and out-of-pocket costs lower for consumers purchasing insurance on the exchanges. Tennessee Insurance Commissioner Julie McPeak telling the committee the cost-sharing reduction payments are not handouts to insurance companies. They're important cost control measures and market stabilizers. The Trump administration has cut funding for advertising for the insurance marketplaces by 90% over last year's budget and has shortened the enrollment period in half. There is little time for the Senate to act, and it's uncertain if they will in time. State insurance commissioners have until the end of the month to set rates for next year. It's a known fact when it comes to mental health services, many Americans are accustomed to going without or long wait times to see a behavioral specialist. And if you're getting your insurance on the insurance marketplaces, you're having an even tougher time, apparently. According to an in-depth investigation by Health Affairs, the statistics aren't good. On average, exchange plans cover just 11% of mental health providers in their states. More than half of psychiatrists aren't part of a single exchange plan. And among mental health providers who aren't doctors, less than 20% were part of any plan's network. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. Rebecca Gee, Secretary of the Louisiana Department of Health, which oversees the state's public health initiatives as well as Medicaid. Dr. Gee is also a practicing obstetrician, gynecologist, having served as director of the state's birth outcomes. She earned her master's in public health from Columbia University, her medical degree from Cornell, and did her residency at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. Dr. Gee, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you, Mark.
Well, first of all, we are so pleased to see that Louisiana seems to be out of the direct path of Hurricane Irma and was spared the worst of Hurricane Harvey. But you have some significant experience with the effects of a massive storm, with Hurricane Katrina never far from mind, and more recently, the 2016 storm that really deluged the Baton Rouge area. And I'm wondering if you could share with our listeners, what are the public health steps that you've taken, and what has your state done that other states should learn from in preparing for these incredibly potent storms?
Sure. Well, Mark, for those who live through Hurricane Katrina, their lives will always be punctuated by before the storm and after the storm. You know, there were many mistakes made. Some of them were just because no city of that size had endured a hurricane disaster of that proportion. You know, 25,000 individuals had to be evacuated post-storm. Almost 2,000 people lost their lives. And so what we've done is a number of things. First and foremost, developed a network. In Katrina, there was a lot of communication going in different directions, but there was not the ability to confirm. There was not an ability to coordinate. We didn't have a disaster response network. We now do. We have a central command. I have what we call our EOC, our operations center, where we coordinate all of the healthcare activities for the state. We're able to, far in advance of a storm, assist facilities with evacuation plans, make sure that they have their generators, what they need to weather the storm or to leave for the storm. We're able to coordinate. We also focus on pre-storm evacuation. So prior to Katrina, folks hadn't experienced that level of devastation. We didn't take the evacuation orders as seriously. Now we really insist that everyone leave. And we have a very robust medical institution evacuation plan that includes making sure that every facility has the ability to evacuate. We now have medical special needs shelters. So prior to the storm, we would have medical staff that would show up and assist in the general shelters. But what we learned was that you have a lot of vulnerable individuals, those who are getting home and community-based services. Some of them need a higher level of care, a nurse to care for them during the day. And so we set up special needs shelters. We have a mega shelter in Alexandria, and we also have one in Baton Rouge that we can set up and maintain and staff. And so now we plan for that. We also have people who are assigned to sheltering duties, assigned to the medically fragile. We also finally have a much more robust command of the data. We use our data to know where people are before the storm who are fragile. We make sure that they have an evacuation plan. So we have a much better handle on where people are.
Well, Dr. Gee, we have issues related to people having gone without prescriptions. We cannot ignore the mental health issues. Maybe you could talk with us a little bit about what health issues you expect will affect the victims of Hurricane Harvey, and how are state health departments helping each other really rise to the challenges that we think we're obviously going to be seeing more of?
So I just got off the phone with Secretary Phillip of Florida's Department of Health, and we spoke about the need to help each other out because, unfortunately, with the climate changing on our globe, we expect these events to happen. We have to expect that these things may happen with more regularity, and unfortunately, on the coast, we're all in the same boat. We were very fortunate with Harvey that the storm did not hit Louisiana, so we were in a very good position to help our brothers and sisters in neighboring Texas. Around 95% of the people who came into our shelters are Texas residents. And we had about 1,900 Texas residents in Alexandria, 60 of those with medical needs. So when we look at folks, the most common thing that happens, and we saw this in the flooding in the Baton Rouge area last August, is that individuals leave quickly. Mm-hmm. They leave without their prescriptions, without durable medical equipment. And so we have now plans in place to make sure that they're able to refill their prescription even if they're not due. And we work out the ability to cross state lines in terms of providing medical care. So those things are fairly seamless. Unfortunately, we get to dust off those plans a little bit more regularly than we would like.
You know, I'm wondering, is really sort of this focusing on providing health services, and have you seen any technology assisters out there that might be helpful to managing populations and keeping track of them? Is anything new in terms of technology that might also give some assistance in disasters like Hurricane Harvey?
Sure. So we've seen significant advances in healthcare technology, and particularly with record keeping, because the most important thing in a storm is knowing where your vulnerable population is and having confirmation of whether they've been able to evacuate. So we now have a single point of entry to report medical assets and also to report medical needs. We have a registry that identifies where every vulnerable individual is in areas that are high risk. And so the advances in IT infrastructure with a single data port of entry allow us to know where people are, what their needs are. And it also allows hospitals to report their capacities, whether their generators are up and running, how many beds are filled at that particular hospital so that we can plan in the condition of an evacuation, grant management systems, post-storm, so that we know where the monies are coming in and how to distribute them. So we're much more prepared from a data standpoint.
Dr. Gee, we had former Louisiana health official Dr. Karen DeSalvo on the show. She talked about one of the casualties of Katrina and how the state rebounded from it was the loss of certainly millions of paper health records, and said that it spurred a dramatic shift in your state to the use of electronic health records. And others talked about the impetus that Katrina gave to really developing a more robust primary care system, really implementing a stronger primary care structure. I wonder if you'd like to share with us a little bit about some of the progress in that area that your state undertook.
So in the wake of Katrina, we developed new and robust primary care facilities in the New Orleans area. But I think more importantly was the decision that Governor Edwards made, which was to expand Medicaid. Here in Louisiana, we have a large number of working poor folks who, one in four of them, were uninsured. No way to access primary care except for, you know, if they went to a charity facility or an emergency room. Now, nearly 440,000 adults, many for the first time in their lives, have access to primary care. And we know that over 100,000 of them have received preventive health services. Tens of thousands have gotten a colonoscopy. 19,000 women have gotten diagnostic breast imaging. 3,000 adults being treated for diabetes, over 30,000 were treated for depression or mental illness. And that's something that we realize post-storm when they have it, lose their homes, lose everything they've worked for, that sometimes potentiates mental illness and stress. And so having a whole system of care for them where they have insurance, can go to a federally qualified health center, have a medical home, and that has been a real sea change for Louisiana.
We're speaking with Dr. Rebecca Gee, Secretary of Louisiana Department of Health, which oversees the state's public health initiative. Dr. Gee, another storm is brewing in the arena of health policy in this country. We watched as the congressional leaders in the White House attempted to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. They're back in session, looking hopefully for a new approach. I'm wondering what your thoughts are about that. And as you mentioned, Governor Edwards really stands out as a real leader in making the expansion you talked about. Tell us about the state's infrastructure to manage 400,000. What strains has that put on the system?
So we have had actually very excellent results in terms of primary care visits in the first year and a half of our program. We've made sure that our managed care companies assign every member to a primary care practitioner. We've done education to make sure that people know that they have an opportunity to receive primary care. We're in the middle of working on a system of care redesign that's focused on primary care. We're looking at hospital rates and things that would potentiate our ability to incentivize primary care, including looking at accountable care models. On the legislative front, I do think this is a good time for bipartisanship. We are seeing that the federal overhaul legislation has failed. You've seen the 11 governors, including my own John Bel Edwards, who signed a bipartisan letter talking about the fundamental principles for health reform. And I'm very optimistic that the bipartisan spirit will continue. What we've seen out of the federal proposal so far is very disappointing. What they don't address are the fundamental drivers of cost. What I see as the biggest challenge is the overall cost of care. We spend double what other countries that are developed spend on healthcare, and we don't have as good of an outcome. We have poor diabetes, and we have poor obesity numbers, and our behavioral health problems are more robust. So we're failing to deliver prevention care, and we're failing to deliver health, so we need to deal with some of the fundamental cost drivers. One of the major ones is pharmaceutical costs. So right now, the taxpayer has to shoulder the burden of whatever pharmaceutical industry wants to charge for their drugs. That results, frankly, in lack of treatment and or higher costs to the healthcare system because those pharmaceutical prices are just so high. So we are addressing that. We're working with the National Governors Association on some work that would lead to some different proposals for some of those drugs that are really common. A good example is hepatitis C, where you have in our state 70,000 people with hepatitis C. And in the Medicaid program, we only treated 320 of them last year. People also spend a lot of money at the end of life for care that they might not even want. You know, people tend to want to die at home, but we do all sorts of very intensive things to them at the end of their life. So what we really need is a very robust discussion about what we can do to get the cost of healthcare down. What happened in the Congress this year was really a discussion about block granting and other mechanisms that would fundamentally result in decreased coverage and in millions of people losing their health care. Let's focus on the things that will bring greater value to the discussion, like how do you cover these people and cover them at a lower cost? How do you promote healthy behaviors? Those are all really important discussions that I really look forward to having over the upcoming year.
I want to look at something that I think has been a success and cause for optimism in Louisiana, and that's the very successful public health initiative that you've overseen as director of the Birth Outcomes Initiative with a goal to decrease infant mortality rates statewide. And we would be really interested in hearing from you on some of the strategy and tactics that you deployed to address birth outcomes.
I'm an obstetrician and continue to see patients, and so I was tasked to come up with some things that would move the state out of the 50th grade that we got and save babies' lives and to help deal with health disparities and help deal with infant mortality. So we set on a very strategic course for things that would work to reduce prematurity and to reduce infant mortality or the number of babies who die before year one. And we set about statewide by educating hospitals, nurses, primary care clinics about what they could do. We spearheaded Healthy Babies Are Worth the Wait along with the March of Dimes, which effectively ended the practice of elective inductions before 39 weeks in Louisiana. We worked on getting every woman progesterone who needs it. Women who are high risk, who have had a preterm baby before, we were doing horrible at that. We've quadrupled the number of women who get progesterone. We also focused on women would be healthy going into a pregnancy, and that women would time their pregnancies for when they were ready. We had a 25% drop in infant mortality in Louisiana last year. That is much higher than the national average of 15% drop over that time.
And congratulations.
We made progress. There were 92 fewer African-American babies who died if stats had just continued in that way, and 160 overall fewer babies who died during that period. So we're really proud of those results.
I know certainly the country as a whole is looking at the devastating impact that the opioid crisis has had, causing so many accidental deaths in this country, and that coupled with the obesity epidemic, which is impacting a third of the nation's children. And I believe obesity numbers may be somewhat higher in the South, but I'm wondering if you could just talk a little bit about how you're thinking about these two chronic and complex health problems and any strategies that you might have crosswalked over from the great results that you were just discussing.
Sure. Well, let me start with the hard one, which is obesity. We are the most obese state in the nation. The number of obese people in our state could fill our Tiger Stadium over 16 times.
Oh, wow.
It's tough, though. We have some of the best food in this country and in the world. People come here to eat our food. So this is a behavior, and behaviors are tough to change. So our Well Ahead program was recently awarded one of the national awards for best prevention programs of any state health department in the country. And this designates well spots and community organizations, businesses that would like to be encouraged and recognized for healthy behaviors and promoting healthy behaviors get a well spot designation. So that's been a great success. Another big challenge is smoking, frankly, and the cost of caring for adults who smoke is tremendously high, and we still need to do a better job getting smoking rates down. So in opioids, we have had tremendous success this legislative session because this has come to such a head. We first started to see it a couple of years ago with increasing rates of what we call neonatal abstinence syndrome. And the real crisis has really just been mounting. And last year, for example, in East Baton Rouge, we saw more overdose deaths than all motor vehicle deaths and homicide deaths combined. So our legislature, our medical association, and our Medicaid program, along with Blue Cross Blue Shield, have partnered to do some very powerful things. One is that we've set 7-day limits. We know that 80% of people who are addicted to heroin start on an opioid. So part of it is just decreasing the number of people that ever get a long-term opioid prescription and have a chance to get addicted. We also had created a 13-member advisory council on heroin and opioid prevention. We strengthened our prescription monitoring program. We also made mandatory medical training for docs so that they know the impact of the opioid epidemic and have more education on addiction. You know, when I went to medical school, we didn't get any training on addiction, addiction treatment. You know, pain was the fifth vital sign. We were told to treat pain. We didn't think a lot about the ramifications of our actions when we prescribed opioids. So this is a sea change in terms of, you know, mandatory education, and I think this will result in much better outcomes for the people of our state.
We've been speaking to Dr. Rebecca Gee, Secretary of the Louisiana Department of Health. You can learn more about the department's work by going to their website, ldh.la.gov, or you can follow Dr. Gee on Twitter at Rebecca Gee MD. Dr. Gee, thank you so much for the incredible work that you're doing and for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
Thank you, Mark and Margaret.
Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lurie Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lurie, what have you got for us this week?
Many readers have asked us whether the herbicide glyphosate causes cancer. The short answer is that there is evidence to suggest it may cause cancer at very high doses, but not at the low doses typically found in foods. Our readers often cited an article on foodbabe.com, which outlines a report that found, quote, alarming levels of glyphosate, the most used herbicide by volume in 2015, in various brands of cereal, cookies, chips, and crackers. In 2015, the International Agency for Research on Cancer did classify glyphosate as, quote, probably carcinogenic to humans. But in 2016, a group of pesticide residue experts at WHO and the United Nations also concluded that glyphosate is, quote, unlikely to pose a carcinogenic risk to humans through their diets. Those conclusions aren't as contradictory as they seem. The 2015 conclusion aims at identifying any potential cancer hazard. But the 2016 assessment looked at actual cancer risk of the herbicide at a specific level of exposure. Using a strict standard from the European Food Safety Authority, a 175-pound adult could ingest nearly 40 milligrams of glyphosate a day without a risk of developing cancer. Alternatively, a child of half that weight could ingest 20 milligrams of glyphosate a day. How does that compare to the amount of glyphosate the report highlighted by FoodBabe found in cereal and other foods? In order to max out an acceptable daily intake, a 175-pound adult would have to eat more than 1,270 servings of Cheerios a day. So yes, glyphosate is found in some foods, but experts believe those doses of the herbicide don't pose a cancer risk to humans. There's more information about several studies on glyphosate on our website at factcheck.org. I'm Lurie Robertson, FactCheck's managing editor.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have factcheck.org's Lurie Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. It's a known fact that the current generation of American children is more obese than any previous generation. And at a Washington, D.C. community health center, Unity Healthcare, a pediatrician was in a quandary over how to tackle this growing health scourge. He began with a unique solution targeted to a teen patient whose body mass index had already landed her in the obese category. What he did was write a prescription for getting off the bus one stop earlier on her way to school, which made her walk the equivalent of 1 mile a day. Dr. Robert Czar of Unity Community Health Center understood that without motivation to move more, kids just might not do it. The patient complied with the prescription and has moved from the obese down to the overweight category. He then decided to expand this program by working with the D.C. Parks Department, mapping out all the potential walks and play area kids have within the city's parks.
How to get there, parking, is parking available if someone's going to drive, bike racks, there's a section on pets. Park safety.
Dr. Czar writes park prescriptions on a special prescription pad in English and Spanish with the words RX for outdoor activity and a schedule slot that asks, When and where will you play outside this week?
I like to listen and find out what it is my patients like to do, and then gauge the parks I prescribe based on their interests, based on the things they're willing to do.
With some 40% of his patient population grappling with overweight or obesity, he wants to make the prescription for outdoor activity adaptable for all of his patients and adaptable for pediatricians around the country. And one day, he'd like to be able to track his patients' activities in the parks. RX for Outdoor Activity, partnering clinicians, park administrators, patients, and their families to move more, yielding fitter, healthier young people. Now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.